Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good morning, everybody. Welcome to today's podcast. In today's segment, we'll be talking with Mr. Adam Austin. He is the cybersecurity lead at a company called Totem Technologies. It's a cybersecurity compliance firm based in West Haven, Utah. Adam, thanks for your time this morning, and let's go ahead and get started, please.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Robbie. Look forward to the opportunity.
My pleasure. My honor. Well, we did some background snooping on you. We didn't do any background checks or anything, but we looked up your bio. We looked you up on LinkedIn, your company's website, and did a little bit of Google searching. And you seem to have a very rich and diversified background in cybersecurity. Can you just give us some of the highlights of your career and what kind of got you motivated to go into cybersecurity? I noticed you have a degree in physics, of all things, right, if I'm correct?
I do, yeah. So I got a degree in physics from a small liberal arts college in Maryland, and it turns out physics is great for problem solving, but it's a little too general of a degree to maneuver directly into the engineering field once you've graduated. So I sort of worked my way through being an educator and failure analyst, and then ended up getting a job building ground control systems for satellites and UAVs, UAVs for the military, and with a company called Textron Systems out of Baltimore. And as part of the UAV systems engineering, I noticed that the information assurance team at Textron, the cybersecurity folks, they looked like they were having more fun than the rest of us. And so I would, when I had downtime, I would ask those guys if I could help them out and learn a little bit about information assurance, aka cybersecurity, and they let me tag along. And I found that I had a knack for it and a passion for it. I saw that it was a good career field. This is all over a decade ago, actually. And haven't looked back since. And so been working for the last 12 years or so in the DOD and Department of Health and Human Services space doing cybersecurity. And our company, about 5 years ago, we won a small business set-aside contract with the U.S. Air Force. And there's a strong cybersecurity aspect to this logistics contract that we run for the Air Force. And so we've been doing that for the last 5 years. And then we spun a sort of sister company, an operating unit off of our primary DOD prime contractor entity called Totem Technologies. And through Totem Technologies, we're offering our expertise and experience helping to our peers in the industry. So our DOD contracting peers, helping them navigate the cybersecurity compliance activities for a contractor that does business with the Department of Defense.
Excellent. Now, is Totem Technologies, is that a company that you've helped to create from the bottom up, or just something that you kind of happened to venture into and the position was just right there, right when you applied, or?
Nope, yeah. I'm a partner and founder of Totem Technologies alongside with my partner, Aliyahu, who we call Ali Bey, and he's the president and CEO of our mother company or our sister company, Haight Bey and Associates, and that's the entity that's the prime contractor for the U.S. Air Force. Totem Technologies is a sister company that Ali and I founded together.
Okay, excellent. Now, how long has Totem been in business? I think you mentioned 5 years, but have the roots for that been longer?
The Haight Bey Associates has been in business for 5 years, and Totem Technologies for the last 3 years. So for the last 4 years, so in 2016, the Department of Defense issued some requirements for cybersecurity for its supply chain, like the contractors, suppliers, vendors that provide services and goods to the DOD. We ourselves, private industry entities, have to maintain a certain level of cybersecurity compliance. And as we journeyed through that compliance, those compliance activities with Haight Bey and Associates, getting that entity compliant, we realized the need for our services for, like I said, our peers in the industry. And that's when we spun up Totem Technologies about 3 years ago.
Excellent. Now, do you have a presence in other countries as well, or are you just local to the U.S., like the East Coast market, or wherever your market is at?
Yeah, the market is the entirety of the 50 states in the U.S. We don't have any work in foreign countries. We're not particularly targeting or marketing work in those countries. It's all U.S.-based work, helping our peers, like I said, in the Department of Defense supply chain build up robust cybersecurity programs.
Okay, excellent. Now, who is your typical customer base? Is it just pretty much the federal government, or do you branch out to the private sector as well, too?
On Hey Bay and Associates side, our customer base is strictly U.S. federal government. On Totem Technologies, our customer base is other private sector entities that either provide services to the DoD or sell products to the Department of Defense. So our typical customer is a small business, fewer than 500 employees, that they're typically building something for the Department of Defense. So in the manufacturing industry and part of the Department of Defense supply chain. So they'll do things like our customers do things like operate industrial control systems and CNC machines. So that's computer numerical code machines, doing things like picking and placing, putting together circuit boards, punching holes in sheet metal for the body of an aircraft, or building nose cones for missiles, or putting together carbon fiber components or hoses for a military aircraft. So building tangible things. That's our typical customer, although we have customers that do other things for the Department of Defense, including brokering services, engineering and design services, staffing for the Department of Defense, logistics for the Department of Defense. It runs the gamut, but the majority of our customers are manufacturers.
Okay, excellent. Now, the bulk of our show is going to be going over the CMMC, the cybersecurity maturity model certification. But before we get started with that, I mean, I'm on your website right now. It seems like you offer quite a range of consulting services, all the way going from risk assessments to pen testing, policy development. I'm particularly interested also in your SCADA services, because I think one area of cyber that's really often overlooked is attacks on critical infrastructure. We have legacy-based systems that are air-gapped, and it's hard to, you just can't rip out the old systems and put new ones in. You have to add on that security one bit at a time. So could you please elaborate a little bit more on some of these services, especially focusing on the SCADA component?
Yeah, sure. So the SCADA is the are all of the automated components in what we call operational technology type of components in industry, really. So these are devices, and like you said, many of them are legacy and had been operating in a non-networked environment and are now being introduced into a networked environment. So these are systems like HVAC systems, heating, ventilation, and air conditioning systems. You mentioned critical infrastructure, so relaying and switching in electrical power generation and transmission systems, or valve opening and closing systems in water filtration and water distribution services. Those sorts of actuating and things that do something physically, like maneuver a lever or flip a switch, and that are controlled electronically by automated logic systems. And those logic systems are now being connected to networks. And because a lot of these types of systems are, like you said, legacy, and they might be 30, 20 years old and now being brought online, so onto the internet or onto a local area network, they weren't built with network security in mind. And so because of that, we're now, so instead of being able to build the security into these industrial control systems, we now have to bolt it on from the outside. That's sort of a euphemism for the state of that we're in with trying to secure these systems after the fact. And it's quite a challenge. A lot of these automated logic systems, automated controllers are very sensitive to external influences, and you can easily break their operation during the process of trying to secure them. So it's a real razor's edge we run sometimes trying to help our customers secure these systems. And what we're talking about are when we speak of securing these systems are some of the basic things like changing default passwords for logging in. Some of these systems, that's actually a challenge to do that because the password is actually baked into the logic itself. And then we have other cybersecurity concepts like patching, fixing bugs and vulnerabilities and weaknesses inherent in the software code. Sometimes you can apply a patch to one of these industrial control system components, and it'll actually break the functionality of the system. And so if we're talking about potentially breaking the functionality of a component that's used to transmit electricity on electrical grid, we're talking about the possibility of leaving folks without power. Now, on the flip side of this are our adversaries, organized crime and nation state level adversaries like Iran, North Korea, Russia, China. They know that about the inherent weaknesses in these SCADA and industrial control systems as well, and they also know about the inherent instability of those systems if you try to, like we said, bolt on the security. And so there's a pretty significant threat to vast parts of our critical infrastructure from these adversaries, either through active or passive attacks on these systems. So you're definitely right. It's a huge source of threat to our national security, the fact that we're bringing legacy, older model industrial control systems online.
Okay. Now, Adam, the next, the big piece of our show is going to be about the CMMC, what's known as a cyber security maturity model certification. I'm in the middle of writing actually a big white paper for a client on that, and I've got a microsite on that I've just launched. Can you just give us a little bit of an overview of the CMMC and what it really means, and before we do a deeper dive into it for our audience?
Yeah, sure. So the CMMC, like you said, is the Cybersecurity Maturity Model Certification, and it is a framework, or as the DoD calls it, an ecosystem that the Department of Defense is spinning up to ensure that its supply chain protects certain types of information for the Department of Defense. So in other words, they're holding us, the members of the Department of Defense supply chain, private sector entities that are part of the industrial base for the Department of Defense. They're holding us accountable for securing certain types of information that we process by virtue of doing work for the DoD. So that's it in a nutshell. And then there's, like you said, there's plenty of rabbit holes we can go down discussing the nuances of this requirement.
Okay. Well, actually, so the next question, what are the current requirements for the Department of Defense or DoD supply chain cybersecurity?
Yeah, so that's a great question. There are all of us that work on federal government contracts process some basic, what's called federal contract information of some kind. So invoices and purchase orders that we send back and forth from our private sector entity to the federal government. Those are what's considered federal contract information. And that type of information requires some basic cybersecurity protections. In fact, 17 basic cybersecurity safeguards. So in things like we have to install antivirus on our workstations and servers, and we have to control physical access to our facilities where this information is stored. So there's this federal contract information that we all federal government contractors have to protect. And then for the DOD, some of us will process a certain subset of federal contract information that bears additional protection requirements. And that subset of information is called controlled unclassified information. The controlled means we have to exhibit some sort of control over who has access to it, how it's disseminated, how it's transmitted, and how it's received by our organization. So it's CUI is the acronym, controlled unclassified information. And for those of us that process that type of information, we have an additional, pretty stringent set of cybersecurity best practices and safeguards to put in place to protect that information when our private sector company either processes it, stores, or transmits CUI. And so where there were 17 basic protections, or AKA safeguards, that we have to put in place for federal contract information in general, for controlled unclassified information, there are 110 safeguards that we have to implement in our private sector business, our private sector organization, to protect CUI.
Okay, well, now, how is that different from, how is the CUI different from the FCI? And can you please kind of explain more what the FCI is, please?
Yeah, so the FCI, like I mentioned, are things, basically any information that's generated by or for a federal contract. So that's a broad swath of types of information. Like I mentioned, invoices, purchase orders, delivery order requests, some RFPs, requests for proposals for the federal government, could actually be identified as FCI as well. So you're basically protecting anything, any information that's related to a federal contract. CUI will be specifically or explicitly identified by the Department of Defense as FCI that's more sensitive in nature and bears additional protective requirements. So an example of CUI in the Department of Defense realm, well, there are four categories of CUI for the Department of Defense. Two are related to nuclear technology. Nuclear propulsion is one, and just general nuclear information is the other. There's a third category of CUI that's for related to critical infrastructure systems. So like we were talking about before, electrical transmission and generation contracts, internet service provision to military bases, water filtering and distribution, that's critical infrastructure. And then the fourth category of DOD-related CUI is called controlled technical information. And these are documents that contain things like engineering drawings, software source code, technical manuals and technical orders, in other words, user manuals for Department of Defense systems. What are some other examples? Research and engineering data, reports, technical reports. So like we have a client that does soil sampling for the U.S. Navy, and those results of the soil test and the analysis on the soil samples, those reports are probably considered CUI, controlled unclassified information, and they bear additional protection above and beyond the basic protection required for federal contract information.
Okay. Now, who is affected by these requirements?
Yeah, so on the DOD side, the Department of Defense is saying that the entirety of its supply chain which there's been varying estimates between 220,000 to 330,000 private sector entities, prime contractors, and the suppliers and vendors that support those prime contractors. The Department of Defense is saying that everyone in the supply chain, every entity in the supply chain is going to be affected. So at, each and every one of us will, at a minimum, have to be certified that we can effectively and securely process FCI. And then there will be a subset of us that will have to be certified that we can securely process CUI, Controlled Unclassified Information. And it's the latest estimates for the number of individual unique organizations that process CUI for the Department of Defense was somewhere around 50,000 companies.
Okay. Now, how many organizations are affected by these requirements? Is it just the defense industrial base, like defense contractors, or it's even the subcontractors of these defense companies and the people they outsource things to? Is it more of a trickle-down effect, in your opinion?
Yep, it's trickle-down. It's all the way down. So it'll start with the prime contractors. And so Haight Bain Associates is a great example of a prime contractor for the U.S. Air Force. And we have four subcontracting vendors under us. One of those is another large prime contractor. I won't say their name, but most people have heard of them. And so we have to flow down these requirements to that contractor. Three of the other three subcontractors to us actually provide a commercial off-the-shelf COTS product. And so if you simply provide a COTS product or to the federal government, then you are exempt, or to the Department of Defense, then you're actually exempt from these requirements. But you can think about other large prime contractors like Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Raytheon. Those folks have hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of unique smaller businesses that are part of the supply chain for the various products and services that they provide to the DOD. And so they have to flow these cybersecurity requirements all the way down through their supply chain. So requirements will trickle all the way down to the mom and pop shop that run a lathe out of their garage, and they happen to build a particular widget very well for one of the prime contractors. That prime contractor is going to have to ensure that mom and pop shop meets these cybersecurity requirements as well.
Okay, now with this trickle-down effect, I'm kind of envisioning it as, you know, the large ones being impacted first and the smallest of the small being impacted the least. What is the impact of small business then in that regard of the supply chain? Is it minimal?
Yeah.
Maybe a lot, or?
It's going to be, if that small business processes controlled unclassified information, so in the case of that mom-and-pop machine shop that runs a lathe out of their garage, they're going to be dealing with engineering drawings, specifications for the part, maybe quality control and quality assurance, or AKA conformance reports that are generated. All of that information is probably going to be considered controlled unclassified information by the DOD. And so they'll have to implement those 110 safeguards at a minimum. And it's a quite a significant impact. You're talking about to engineer and implement the technology in your IT system, you're talking about tens of thousands of dollars on an ongoing basis to implement the technology. And then you have to do things like train your users. You have to develop a cybersecurity culture within your organization to truly meet all of these safeguarding requirements for this information. And so, like I said, it's going to be tens of thousands of dollars at least annually. And that's a significant impact to small business members of the supply chain. In fact, this impact inevitably will remove some members of the Department of Defense supply chain that just can't afford to implement some of these these cybersecurity requirements.
Okay. Now, the CMMC is going to go through some big changes, I think, coming up, unless it's already happened, from this month and next month. What are these changes? Because there's still a lot of, from the people I talk to, and from what I see on the internet, there's still a lot of confusion out there. But could you maybe, to the best that you know, what are these changes that are coming up from the DOD that they have to, that these subcontractors and contractors have to be CMMC certified?
Yeah, so we're talking on November 12th. As of November 30th, the Department of Defense will have in its hands the ability to include some additional clauses, some additional requirements in the DFARS, which is the Department of Defense Federal Acquisition Regulation Supplement. It's the contracting Bible for the Department of Defense. And there are three new clauses that it'll be able to inject into new contracts going forward. So basically starting in December, many of us that are planning on bidding on Department of Defense contracts or have follow-on contracts that are issued to us as part of a recompete process, we're going to have some new requirements. The first requirements will be to perform a cybersecurity self-assessment under using a National Institutes of Standards and Technology standard for cybersecurity. That's the standard that lists those 110 safeguards I've been mentioning a couple of times. We're going to have to self-assess against that standard according to a assessment methodology or following an assessment methodology. And that's going to generate that methodology will generate a score for us, so sort of compliance score. And we're going to have to report that score to the DOD, whose contracting officers will then evaluate those scores as part of contract award activities. And then the Department of Defense has also spun up a wing or a branch of its contract management agency to perform what they call higher confidence assessments on us. So that self-assessment would represent a basic level of confidence in our compliance. But the contract managing agency through their wing that they spun up, which is going to be called the DIBCAC, Defense Industrial Based Cybersecurity Assessment Center, DIBCAC for short, they're going to be tasked with performing several hundred medium or higher level confidence assessments on, like I said, several hundred members of the supply chain on an annual basis. So that's the first part of the changing requirements. And those requirements constitute two of those three new clauses that the DOD will have available to it. The third is the clause that allows the DOD to require an official third-party certification of the maturity of our cybersecurity program. And that certification will be called the CMMC, the Cybersecurity Maturity Model Certification. And under that, if we have that requirement in contracts, and they can start requiring this in December, then we, as a member of the supply chain for the DOD, will have to procure a licensed third-party assessment organization to come assess our cybersecurity culture and program at our organization. And they'll be assessing it against those there are various levels of CMMC, which we can get into, but they'll be assessing it against a standard and using a methodology that's currently being developed. And they will issue a certification to us, a yes or no, thumbs up, thumbs down, sort of license to operate. And without that certification, we will not be able to do business with the DOD. No matter where we are in the supply chain, we're going to have one of these certifications. So those are the changes coming. Starting in December, the DOD will really start holding us accountable for these cybersecurity requirements.
Okay. Well, yeah, the CMC is pretty. It's a big jigsaw puzzle out there for sure. Now, I know that the CMC actually has its roots in the NIST frameworks, especially the NIST 800-171 document. And there are differences between the two. Could you please elaborate on what these differences or nuances are for our audience, please?
Yeah, sure. So CMMC draws from several different sources, industry sources of cybersecurity best practices, what we call controls, or you can think of these things as best practices or safeguards, the things that you should be doing as a company to protect information. So CMMC draws heavily upon that 800-171 document that I mentioned before. So that's a National Institutes of Standards and Technology special publication, 800-171, which includes 110 best practices for securing information. And these best practices run the gamut from ensuring that your organization can detect and respond to cybersecurity incidents, making sure your organization has a cybersecurity awareness and training program for staff so your staff can recognize risks and threats. There are also plenty of technical capabilities that the organization has to have. Antivirus installed, for instance. It has to have firewalls installed and network segmentation and a slew of other best practices that help both establish a defensive posture to help try to prevent attack, but then also allow the organization some resiliency to attack and the ability to detect and respond and recover from attacks should they happen. So the CMMC draws from 800-171, but it also draws from other sources. And so for those of us that process CUI, the Controlled Unclassified Information, we're actually going to have to be certified at what's called CMMC Level 3, which includes all of the NIST 800-171 controls, as well as an additional 20 controls that are drawn from other sources, such as the Australian Cybersecurity Center's Essential 8. It draws from the Centers for Internet Security Top 20, and a couple of other industry sources of best practices. So it's like I said, there are 20 additional practices in CMMC Level 3. For those companies, those members of the supply chain that don't process the controlled unclassified information, they just process federal contract information. Those folks will have to be certified at a minimum CMMC Level 1. And CMMC Level 1 incorporates those basic 17 controls, basic best practices that I mentioned at the start of the conversation.
Okay. Now, what does it mean to be mature with respect to the CMMC? I know that most defense contractors and all the people that kind of trickled up and are trying to get at least up to maturity level 3. But what does it mean to be mature? Are there other higher levels of certification a company can get?
Yeah, so, well, let me clarify. It won't be most of us that have to be certified at level 3. It will be a significant portion of us that have to be level 3. So they're estimating, they being the DOD, they're estimating about 50,000 of the 220,000 members of the supply chain will have to be certified at level 3. So that's somewhere around 30% or so. Now let's see, let's do a quick division here. Yeah, about 23% of the supply chain will have to be certified at level 3. The vast majority will be certified at CMMC level 1. But one of the M's in CMMC is maturity, right? So this is the concept of maturity with cybersecurity is going to be a foreign concept to a lot of your listeners. Many of us associate cybersecurity with information technology. A lot of us think it's an IT problem, right? We just need a firewall in place and we're good to go. We're cyber secure. That's a fallacy. In truth, a robust cybersecurity program and an organization's ability to truly protect information means developing a cybersecurity culture within an organization, and that culture development would display a level of maturity within an organization. So does an organization implement the technology, but does it also have the folks with the skills in-house or outsourced to actually use the technology properly? Does it document its expectations for the outcome of the cybersecurity program? Does it gather metrics? Does it measure the effectiveness of the safeguards that are in place? And does it do this repeatedly? Those are all indicators of a mature cybersecurity program. And so I mentioned that concept of to be compliant and to have maturity, an organization is going to have to develop a cybersecurity culture. I liken this to a safety culture within an organization. There are lots of motivators for a company to build safety features into its organization and to train its users on safety protocols and to require certain safety protocols. Those motivators can range from the altruistic, like the executive leadership truly wants to take care of its employees' health and safety. But it can also be the other side, where the company's looking to reduce its liability, both to workman's comp claims and lawsuits due to unsafe working environments, right? And it's probably a mix of those two extremes, motivators for building a safety culture. But no matter what, many organizations build a safety culture where the executive leadership always follows the same safety protocols that it expects of its line workers. So they put on their safety glasses when they enter the machine shop. They wear their hard hat on the construction site or their steel-toed boots, right? They wear their safety vest at all times when they are in dangerous environments. And they promote safety within the organization through training and motivational techniques, maybe even reward techniques for not having safety mishaps. We're in an analogous sense, we want to build a similar cybersecurity culture within our organization, where everyone from the top down, from executive leadership to the line workers, take cybersecurity seriously and practice the best practices on a daily basis. So the maturity aspect of CMMC is going to require that of the organizations in order to achieve a CMMC certification.
Well, now, what will CMMC impact be to small the businesses differently than what the NIST frameworks would be?
Yeah, so that's a great question, and it's going to be a significant increase in impact to small businesses. Right now, both monetary and time, and like I said, culture, right? So if you don't have a cybersecurity culture, you're going to have to develop one. That's going to be an impact right there. But from a monetary standpoint, right now, we are, those of us that process CUI and would be targeting CMMC level 3, right now, in terms of certification or in terms of compliance, we are just required to self-assess and attest that we have implemented all of the best practices. When the CMMC comes around, we're going to have to put our money where our mouth is, and we're going to have to hire a third party to perform that assessment. The Department of Defense has estimated that on an annual, ongoing basis, just the assessment portion of a CMMC Level 3 certification will cost a small business somewhere around $60,000. Annually, forever, ongoing, as long as that business plans on doing work with the DOD. And that's just the assessment part. It doesn't factor in the cost of actually implementing the 130 best practices that are included in a level 3. In fact, the Department of Defense sort of dismisses any notion of implementation costs. They're assuming that we have already done our due diligence and have abided by our contractual requirements and have already implemented the NIST 800-171 controls. So those of us that have not yet implemented them are looking at, like I said, tens of thousands of non-reimbursable, non-recurring engineering costs just to get compliant. So it's a significant impact and a significant increase as well over and above the current paradigm.
Okay. Well, now I'm going to put these two questions together as one here. I have had some companies kind of reach out to me, you know, on the phone or whatever, saying, hey, what do I do to come into compliance with CMMC and where can I get help? And I'm going, well, I'm not an expert in this area, but I can definitely refer you to someone. So there are a couple of other consulting companies I know that do this specifically. But in your view, what should a small business be doing right now? And where can they get help in coming into compliance? Should they just reach out to you directly? Or are there other resources that they should be looking out for? Could you please kind of explain that to our audience, please?
Yeah, so the first thing that they're going to need to do if they haven't done anything in terms of DoD cybersecurity compliance is educate themselves. And, yeah, they can reach out to us directly. This is what Totem Tech's bread and butter is the education and training part on what are these requirements and what type of approach do you need to take to start on that compliance journey. And we run workshops on a monthly basis. They're 9-part workshops where we start with an overview and introduction to the requirements and then bite-sized manageable chunks for these organizations to chew on. In other words, pluck the low-hanging fruit, start with the low-hanging fruit for implementing some of these best practices, and then we move on to some of the more challenging capabilities they have to implement and help them develop the blueprints for their cybersecurity program. But the first step is going to be separating the signal from the noise. So finding the truth in what are the requirements, what does your organization do, what types of information does it process for the Department of Defense, what target level CMMC or what level of CMMC will your organization probably be targeting, and that will provide the indicator of how many and what type of best practices you have to put in place to secure that information. So if a small business, one of your listeners has no idea, they just started hearing about this, they have no idea where to start, it starts with education and determining where you are in this DoD ecosystem to determine what your requirements actually are.
Now, are there other steps that a SMB or another company should take if they don't have cybersecurity maturity in place to begin with?
Yeah, so the first steps we take with our clients is to lead them through an exercise in determining the life cycle of Department of Defense-related information through their organization. So as a small business, once you know that once you understand that you're in the DoD ecosystem and you understand that you have some cybersecurity compliance requirements, now you have to understand how that Department of Defense information flows throughout your organization. So we lead our clients through an exercise where we ask them to identify all the sources of Department of Defense information. So who do you receive this information from? Is it directly from the Department of Defense? Do you download it from websites like DIBS, CFolders, the SAFE app, SAM, betasam.gov? Do you receive it through email from the Department of Defense or through email from a prime contractor or through some other file sharing service? Or do you generate it all internally or a portion of it internally? So where do you get the information from? Then the next step is, how do you store it internally? Do you store it on-premise? Do you use cloud services? Do you back it up externally? And then who can access it once you have it? So identify all of the folks within your organization that have access to it, and how do they access it when it's in your possession. And then also, who do you transmit it to externally, and how? So do you have to send this information back up to your prime contractor? Do you have to send it to the Department of Defense? Do you have to flow it down to your vendors and suppliers? And how do you do that? And then also, at the end of the contract or the end of the period of usefulness of this particular piece of information, how do you dispose of it? So let's say you have, let's talk about an engineering drawing in this example, okay? We'll have clients that download engineering drawings directly from Department of Defense hosted website, DIBs or C folders are examples of those. So they download it across the through a web browser, across the internet. They hand it off to an engineering team internally to develop specifications or machine code to build the part that the engineering drawing is representing. And then they may also hand off drawings to program managers internally. They may hand them off to accounting folks to develop cost structure and invoicing. And so they process all of this internally on workstations, servers, cloud servers maybe. They back it up to cloud services maybe. And then there might be subcomponents that are part of this engineering drawing that they might have to then transmit to a supplier. So let's say we're talking about a valve that goes in the engine for a missile. The valve might have it might be in a machine shop that's downloading an engineering drawing for this valve so that they can machine a piece of aluminum into the to meet the specifications. But they may have to have that part, once it's machined, they may have to send it out for powder coating, for painting. And so they would have to send some specifications, some information out to their supplier that does the powder coating. So the organization needs to determine how they transmit that information. And then, like I said, let's say they print out the engineering drawing as part of their manufacturing process. They need to determine how they are going to dispose of the paper copies of the engineering drawings once they're finished. Do they shred it? Do they burn it? Do they put it in a box and lock it up in a closet? Once they've determined what we call the life cycle of the information through their environment, who do you get it from? How do you store it? Who do you transmit it to? And how do you dispose of it? They can then start establishing the footprint of all of their system that's used as part of that life cycle. And so by system, we're talking about IT stuff like hardware, software. So workstations software would be like computer-aided design, CAD software. So the network components that support the hardware and software connections, so like your switches, your firewalls, your wireless access points. And then you can identify the people that use all of the hardware and software, your users. And then you can identify the processes, policies, and procedures that those users, the use of the system is dictated by the types of policies. And so all of that stuff encompasses what we call the system. And they can start then cataloging all of the components of the system. And then once you know what your system is, once you know what the footprint of your system is, you can start applying security best practices to the system. But that first step, after educating yourself on what the requirements are, the first step is to do that life cycle determination and scoping or footprinting of your system.
Okay, excellent. Is there anything more you'd like to add on this part of the show about the CMC before we segue more into the general cybersecurity landscape?
No, I think that's it. Just that if this is the first time you're hearing about it, there are sources of truth out there and sources of misleading information. We like to fashion ourselves as a source of truth. So you can look at our website, totem.tech. We also have a knowledge base. It's a subreddit on Reddit. It's the Totem Knowledge Base subreddit. So you can look up there. We capture only what we know to be the truth about all of these requirements.
Okay, excellent. Now, I just wanted to kind of pick your brain on some of the major other cyber threats that could relate to CMMC in some. The first one is artificial intelligence. What are your views on AI? That's one of the big buzzwords right now. And I've got a book that's going to be coming out in print, I believe, next February. It's a wide field. I think it's an overused term in cybersecurity. A lot of people just don't really understand it. What's your viewpoint on that? Does your company make, does Totem Tech make use of any AI tools in their processes? Or
No, not at all. We're not in that space. We're not a managed service provider. We are a we help the organizations get trained up on the requirements and build the foundations of a cybersecurity program. And then we partner with managed service providers. But so AI is a whole can of worms. So I'm actually just finishing up a book called Super Intelligence by Nick Bostrom. I don't know if you've heard of it, but it goes into some of the really scary aspects of the coming AI revolution. And it's quite clear, you know, reading Mr. Bostrom's definitions of artificial intelligence, that we are not there yet. And it's totally a buzzword in the industry. So we don't have machines that can function independently on tasks yet for artificial intelligence. But it is, we have a lot of products out there that are touting themselves as artificial intelligence. So here's our box with an AI in it that can help solve all of your cybersecurity problems. It'll recognize every threat that is arrayed against you, recognize every vulnerability you have, and plug those holes up and just basically eliminate risk. And that's just a fallacy. Those black boxes, this type of silver bullet boxes, just don't exist yet. And they're true general artificial intelligence is decades away. That's basically my thought on it. It's a buzzword at this point. It's still reliant on hard-coded computer logic to perform very specific tasks. And some of those logic systems can be easily defeated in ways that we could not have forethought.
Right. Well, actually, my dad was a professor of neuroscience at Purdue, and he was involved in spinal cord regeneration research. And I did some work in his lab when I was growing up, when I was in high school. And, you know, at that time, he told me we will never understand the human brain. I mean, we're only at like 0.00001%. That's probably as far as we'll get. I don't think we'll really ever truly understand the human brain or how it really works, or for that matter, even imitate it. It's just such a complex organism. But anyway, I just want to know what
have you
about.
Yeah, have you read that book, Superintelligence by Nick Bostrom?
No, I haven't, but I'll take a look at it. I'll Google it and I'll take a look where I can maybe get a copy of that somewhere.
Yeah, there's another one by Roger Penrose, a famous British physicist, called The Emperor is a New Mind, where he would take the same, I think he takes the same opinion that your dad does, in that there are quantum processes in our brain that we may never be able to understand and much less try to replicate. But Nick Bostrom, I think, is a little bit more optimistic that we would eventually be able to replicate the human brain. We are just so far away from that right now. And that even the technology to be able to do the basic type of scanning of our brain doesn't even exist yet. So,
no, I mean, I don't think it will really ever exist. I mean, all we'll probably understand are what neurons and dendrites are, for that matter. But really, in my book, when I submit the final manuscript, really AI systems, all it is just in a very high level, just garbage in, garbage out. I mean, it's only as good as the data that you're feeding it, and all you're really using are some very high level algorithms, you know, statistical algorithms, which already are out there. Yeah, it's just another way of making things a little bit faster to kind of compute rather than having, you know, human being kind of go through all these hidden data sets. The one big advantage I found of an AI system is that it can actually detect, you know, hidden trends a lot quicker than what a human being could or could take days.
Yeah.
And in some areas that could be advantageous in predicting the, you know, what the future threat landscape could look like. So that's what I
Yeah, there's
a so.
a lot of your anti-malware systems. Isn't the joke that artificial intelligence right now is just more if statements in your software source code, and machine learning, on the other hand, is just better databases? But yeah, there are very impressive antivirus programs out there that, especially the endpoint detection and response type programs, CrowdStrike and Cylance are a couple that come to mind. Very impressive, and some of those endpoint detection software tout that AI, that the notion that they have some AI in there, and they are impressive. But like you said, they're easily defeatable if you train them up with garbage in, garbage out. So if the environment that they're exposed to is full of noise, they may be able to detect the signal in the noise, but it might not be the signal that you're interested in. So they fail in unforeseen ways.
Well, and then that's where the data cleansing comes into play. You got to keep your data feeds, your intelligence feeds cleansed at all times. You got to make sure optimal so that the data, you know, that's being fed into it will get the desired outputs that you're looking for. So that's another big pain in the process too, is making sure that your data sets are as robust and as cleansed as much as possible, as you said, you know, from all that noise.
Yeah, and you've
Now the first.
defined the goal and the goal of the system precisely as well. That's one of the really scary things about this superintelligence book is once we build a true general AI, we're going to have to set it up with goals and motivations that match ours. Otherwise, it could go rogue and have disastrous consequences for the human race.
Well, it'll never come. I mean, talking about human motivation, we'll never get those into a computer. It's such a huge, complex psychological topic. You know, I don't think we'll ever
Yeah.
come close to even. But anyway, the next topic I want to kind of pick your brain a little bit about is the Internet of Things, the IoT. I just got an ebook that just kind of came out on that. Honestly, I don't like the Internet of Things. I think it's a very scary proposition where everything's kind of all networked together. I don't have a smart
Yeah.
home, smart car. You know, I see my financial advisor. He's got one of these James Bond cars. He claps his hand out, and the car backs up. I don't have that. I just have an old Honda Civic Analog, you know, 03 car. That's good enough for me. What are your thoughts on that? I mean, do you have a smart home or a smart car or smart appliances, smart TV for that matter?
Not at all. I'm with you. I'm actively trying to avoid the quote unquote smart technology because by smart they mean networked, right? And anything that is
Right.
networked is vulnerable. And so I'm, as a cybersecurity professional, one of my goals is to make my life and my network as invulnerable or as least vulnerable as possible, right? So I don't understand why my refrigerator needs to be connected to my Wi-Fi. The convenience, I guess I can see it that it gives me a text message when I need to order milk, but I'm at home using the refrigerator. I can tell when I need to order milk, right? Like, I don't understand
Right.
that. They tout it as they're sort of inventing these convenience items, they being these Internet of Things vendors. I hope it's a fad. I suspect that it's not, and that it's here to stay, the Internet of Things, because, you know, my own family uses tools like Alexa, and when you tell Alexa to play Jimmy Buffett and not have and save that time of the interfacing with your phone and bringing up YouTube and or bringing up Spotify, going and finding Jimmy Buffett and playing Jimmy Buffett, and you can just say it verbally, like, it's super convenient. But at the same time, Alexa's listening to you all the time, and you don't know what's being done with that information that it's gathering on you. So our privacy is seriously at risk. Like I said, I hope it's just a fad, but I suspect that it's not, and that our privacy is going to be irreparably compromised. So I actively avoid it. I'm the smartest thing I have in my daily life is my cell phone, and I know it's listening to me. If I'm talking about private matters, I do things like put it in another room. But yeah, so but then so like there's this privacy aspect of it, of the Internet of Things, but there's also all of the vulnerabilities that it introduces into a network. So bringing your Wi-Fi connected mini fridge into your cubicle, if that fridge does not, if the vendor of that fridge doesn't have a patching plan to fix bugs and vulnerabilities in the software on that refrigerator, then if that refrigerator is connected to your corporate network through the Wi-Fi, then you've introduced yet another source of potential infection, source of potential data exfiltration into your network, and you, your standard average user doesn't even put a second thought into connecting that fridge to your corporate Wi-Fi. So it's and there's just thousands more and more every day of these types of Internet of Things entities. But yeah, so what? How do you feel about it? You said you're avoiding it. You don't. For what reasons?
I it's like you use that great analogy. If I need more milk, why get a text message? I mean, I eat cereal every morning almost, you know, and I know when I need milk. So why have a smart something tell me I need more milk, right? Just, I guess I'm an old-fashioned guy. I'm just not really into, I mean, okay, we're in technology, we're in cybersecurity, but there's a flip side, too. I kind of do hate technology when it just kind of just governs our everyday life. Because here in Chicago, I don't know if you've been to Chicago before, a couple of years ago, just to give you a point of example, we had a horrible polar vortex. I can't remember, it was maybe 2 years ago, where the wind chills got down to like minus 80 or minus 90 degrees. And luckily, my Honda Civic, that old-fashioned clunkers, it started the first time. But then I started thinking, you know, about all these other smart cars. What if one of these electronic components gets frozen? Everything depends on that one thing in a cascading effect. Well, if that thing goes under, then you got to diagnose it, repair it. It's just a big pain in the butt, right? It just introduces more points of failure. What's necessary? That's why I don't like it.
I agree.
I don't even have any mobile apps. I just have me my Yahoo mobile app, and that's about it. I don't like those either. It's just a very, you know, if you're gonna send me an email. Why do I need to have 20,000 mobile apps? If I'm gonna log in and check my, you know, my bank, just log in there. Where I think it's much more secure than using a mobile app, because with mobile apps, you don't even know. Secure.
Yeah. The one of the things we train on our users, our employees and our user base is every app that you install on your phone is another point of vulnerability for your phone. So, like Chick-fil-A now has the ordering app, right? How do I know how well maintained Chick-fil-A's app is, and why do I want to introduce that into my phone? But more and more of these companies are forcing you to actually go through their app to interact with the company. I'm trying to think of – I don't remember what restaurant it was. It was a chain restaurant, I know, but I couldn't call the restaurant to order carryout food. I had to go through their app. So I have to install the app. I only wanted to use it one time. It's during coronavirus, right? We're away from home, and I wanted to get some carryout food instead of going into a restaurant. Instead of being able to call them and order some takeout, I had to install their app, install it for one-time use, and then immediately remove it. It's actually more of an inconvenience now for those of us that are security-minded to do that instead of just being able to call and talk to somebody. Super frustrating. I can give you another example in our environment. We have a treadmill. We have a little gym in our office. We have a treadmill there, and it's one of these new treadmills that has a screen on it, and you can load up like kind of like a movie that plays, and you can act like you're jogging through the Alps, or you like
right.
you're jogging on the Great Wall of China, right? And I'm like, it's not fooling me when I'm jogging on the treadmill. I don't really think I'm in the Alps. I guess it's cute, but in order to load up these simulated jogging environments, it has to be connected to the Wi-Fi. And this treadmill was, or we do network traffic monitoring, and we kept noticing on our network the DNS queries. So queries of trying to translate a URL like Google into an actual IP address, right? Your users, some of your users will know, or your listeners will know what DNS is. We noticed that DNS queries were being repeated. So like a workstation would query google.com, and then a few seconds later on our network, the same query would go out, google.com. And we were like, why is this happening? So we do some investigations, some network traffic analysis, and realize there's some bug in the software of our treadmill that is promiscuously or causing the network card to promiscuously listen to the network and duplicate every DNS query. I don't know that it was malicious. I don't know that it had any negative effects. But either way, it was not expected and definitely anomalous. And so we kicked that thing even off of our guest network. It's like, this is just buggy software. There's no way to upgrade or patch the software. The vendor isn't, it's a one and done configuration and software install for that treadmill. So you have no recourse to fix some of these bugs and vulnerabilities in these systems.
Right. Yeah, it's just, I try to stay away from that. So anyway, the next area I wanted to get your ideas on was cybersecurity insurance policies dealing with these small, medium-sized businesses. Have you ever come across where they've talked to you about getting a cybersecurity insurance policy, or that's something you just don't
go
to? Or?
Oh, no, we're actually required to have them to operate in the environment that we operate in.
Okay.
So, yeah, it's a matter of the bottom line is I don't know how I feel about them, and luckily, I'm going to knock wood, we haven't had to file a claim against our policy yet. I would really advise any of your listeners to really do the research on cybersecurity insurance policies. They're going to ask you, if the company is legitimate, they're going to ask you to fill out a pretty extensive questionnaire describing your organization's environment. So, you know, who are your customers? What type of information do you receive from your customers? What type of security best practices do you already have in place? What type are you looking to put in place in the future? And then, so I wouldn't go with a fly-by-night company that doesn't ask you some of those questions so that they can tailor a policy for you. And then on the flip side of that, I would really look at the resultant policy to make sure that it's covering your potential losses. So I was reading, I don't want to speculate or try to remember what the name of the report was. There's a couple of annual industry reports on that catalog and do some analysis on breaches across industry sectors. But I read in one of these reports that the average cybersecurity incident response cost for a small business is, the average minimum is $50,000. And the average cost period is $1 million for recovery from a cybersecurity incident like ransomware or intellectual property theft, right? And a separate related statistic is that the 60% of small businesses that incur a cybersecurity incident go out of business within 6 months. So if the average cost of a cybersecurity incident response is $1 million and 60% of your small businesses can't absorb that, they go out of business within 6 months, then you want to make sure your cyber policy covers the threats that you face, especially ransomware, and covers you for at least that average incident expenditure, that $1 million, right? So there's a lot of variables that go into place. That's my opinion. I'd love to hear what yours are, Robbie.
It's funny you bring that up because I'm actually writing a book on that. It's going to start in December. It's going to be talking about cybersecurity risk, and a chapter on that's going to be cybersecurity insurance policies. Now, I don't know. I'm not a like in the insurance field, but I know that you really have to be careful with who you go with and what you pick because especially the SMBs, you know, who don't have the money to hire like a lawyer to really do the homework as to what they're getting. A lot of them simply feel, oh, I just got the cybersecurity insurance. It's like getting health insurance. You think you're covered, but you're not. They think, oh, I've got this, the coverage, I'm fine. You know, I'll get the money if I'm hit, but very likely you may not get the whole payoff that you want because there's what they call, I think, Class A coverage and some addendums, and it's like a terrorist attack or another kind of attack. And then, you know, there are indirect costs. You got to make sure that you're covered. I mean, yeah, insurance will cover the direct costs. Like if you hit your, like if you're in a car accident, you know, you're in a fender, but yeah, your insurance company will cover those direct costs, but then there are indirect costs, like maybe some medical claims if your neck is slightly, you know, out of twist from that, or same thing like with the cybersecurity tech. I mean, how do you cover, you know, like lost, you know, like your brand reputation that may have been damaged, lost customers, you know, what if you're filed with lawsuits? I know if all that's covered, and that's a very, very gray, very tricky area. And it's just, it takes a lot of homework, and you really have to have a good attorney that knows what they're doing in that realm. I only know maybe one or two, but that's going to be a chapter in my book. It's going to be on cybersecurity insurance policies, and that book's going to cover like how to count cyber risk and this and that, because a lot of insurance companies, they're not simply awarding blanket policies. I mean, they're also making like the entity that wants these cybersecurity risk insurance, I mean, these policies, they're making sure that they have a certain level of compliance also. They want to make sure that they're doing pen testing, threat hunting. They have a security model in place, security policy. And on top of that, these companies could still be audited down the road by this insurance company. And if they don't, their insurance will be pulled from them. Now, it's not, that's not insurance and car insurance or anything like that, but you just don't know because they want to obviously award, you know, those policies to those low risk categories. But, you know, it's such a gray area. You got to really, if you don't know, you got to really do your homework. And two, if not, you need to get a good attorney that really knows this industry or a cybersecurity consulting company that really knows this industry very, very well because it's still evolving. And given with the COVID pandemic, it's going to change a lot more next year, I think. You know, it's very complicated to understand. So my two cents.
Folks working from home and introducing new. Oh, sorry, I cut you off.
No.
You're totally right on the COVID changing things because more and more of us are working from home, which changes the risk environment. So does that negate some aspect of your policy? You brought up the fact that some of these policies are going to require penetration tests on your company. And, you know, truly, what is a penetration test? What will constitute a penetration test in their mind? A simple vulnerability scan of your external facing systems? That's not a penetration test, but a lot of snake oil salesmen in our business will sell you a penetration test when all it is a vulnerability scan. Like, what suffices? So, you got to really do your homework. I agree.
Yeah, and unfortunately, it's just you got to really get in with a good cyber company that knows what they're talking about, the cyber insurance stuff, and make sure you're covered because it's like health insurance. I mean, I'll be honest with you. I had a heart attack about 8 years ago, and I had quintuple bypass surgery, and I thought I was pretty well covered. But I got my heart surgeon's bill. He charged me $6,000, you know, $1,000 for each graft. And insurance only covered $3,000. Now, where am I going to come up with the other $3,000 to pay this thing, right? So it's just, you just don't know what's going to happen. But anyway, that brings us up to the next topic I want to talk to you about is the remote workforce and COVID. How has that impacted you, your clients, your business, and so forth?
Yeah, it's impacted every single one of our clients and ourselves. Luckily, we were almost 100% set up to support remote work. So our facilities is in Utah, and pretty early on, Utah recommended, if not required, I can't recall, but required all non-essential workers to work from home. So we were pretty well set up to do that because we had cybersecurity standpoint, we had policies in place that dictated how the security safeguards that we expect from our home environments. We had policy statements. So best practices like don't use the P modem as your Wi-Fi router. Buy a separate Wi-Fi router that you control over and that you can configure and connect to that instead of your ISP modem. And we had an employee or two that didn't have one of those that needed to go start working from home. So we bought Wi-Fi routers to support their home work environment. And there's several other best practices that you can put in place. You know, lock up your machine. Don't use a BYOD machine, so don't bring your own device. Use a corporate provided laptop or workstation. And, then always follow the same protocols you would at the facilities as far as recognizing phishing emails, not browsing to suspect websites on your corporate machine. Don't use Facebook on the corporate machine. All these policies still translate even though you're working from home, right? And then we set up the ability to do the monitoring that we need to do. So we extended our audit and accountability capability to monitor those home machines as well. Our clients, many of them were not prepared, and it was a serious scramble. In fact, in March, I was on site at a client's site in California when all of the coronavirus craziness started happening and things started shutting down and airlines started canceling flights, and it started getting pretty scary. And I was on site when the company started going into remote work mode, and they were not prepared. They were one of those companies that insisted that everybody come into the brick and mortar. And so we actually transitioned from helping them prepare for the CMMC into basically full on helping them build an alternate work site security policy and program, so that the IT folks could appropriately provision all of the laptops that they were buying in bulk to get this company prepared to do remote work. And it was a serious scramble. So I guess lessons learned out of that and advice out of that is to establish a comprehensive work from home or remote work policy. So that's a set of statements that dictate the expectations for your work-from-home users. And that policy should include cybersecurity expectations. And get that together early on, right? For many of us, it's going to be too late because coronavirus we're 8 months into it. Some states didn't suffer early on are now suffering, like the, you know, Midwest states, Dakotas, those folks. Get that policy in place so that you don't have to scramble when the time comes. Does that answer your question? I can't remember what the original question was now.
Well, no, it does. I mean, this is a complicated topic. It's going to evolve and grow over time. But my biggest concern is intermingling of the home networks into the corporate networks. There are a lot of hot button issues with that, and trying to deploy software upgrades and patches in normal fashion. But we'll see. In fact, I just signed a book deal with CRC Press, my publisher. I'm going to be writing another book actually in May coming up about COVID-19. It's going to be about the lessons learned from the pandemic. It's going to be like a CISO, CIO's how-to pandemic guide, how to avoid the next pandemic, with the lessons that have been learned with COVID-19. So that's going
to
be
a book
right there. Well, I'd love
to guest write a chapter if you're interested.
Hey, if you want to be my guest, maybe we can talk more about that later. But yeah, that's in fact, the first chapter of the book is going to be getting into the molecular biology of what the coronavirus is. That's going to be my chapter, and my other co-author divvied up the chapters. We're going to be talking about, like, lessons learned, what can be done, especially how to, you know, use a cloud like Azure or AWS to deploy the mobile workforce. Because their mobile workforce now, I think, is going to be permanent now. A lot of companies are now starting to realize the benefits of it now, actually. You know, why spend $2,000 a month in rent? You know, it's $24,000 almost. That could be used in research and development, maybe hiring more salespeople to get more revenue, right?
Yeah, I think ultimately this will be a good thing for us. All the reduced commute time and the reduced pollution, reduced wear and tear on infrastructure from all of us that were commuting beforehand. And yeah, ultimately I think it will be good. I will note, you mentioned relying on the cloud to support the remote work environments, and the cloud services like Amazon and Azure, as you mentioned, Microsoft 365, those are fantastic services, but you have to be wary that if you're going to use those services and do work for the federal government, there are requirements for what cloud services you can actually use. They have to be, in a lot of cases, they have to be authorized by the federal government through a program called FedRAMP before you can start using those services to store or transmit or process federal government related information. So you can't just jump in and say, yep, we're going all Microsoft 365, all in the cloud, or we're going to go store all of our information in an Amazon S3 bucket. If you're on a federal contract, you have to pick the right flavors of those services. Yeah, we can help. Help our clients navigate through that selection process on a daily basis, really. That's a huge source of work for us.
Well, what do you find is more government-friendly, Azure or the AWS? Or both, really, for that matter?
Yeah, they both have a tier of service that can be used as part of federal government contracts. So AWS is their GovCloud. And then as far as Azure, like the specific Microsoft product, M365, is based, or certain tiers are based in certain flavors. I'm using weird words here, but certain aspects of Microsoft 365 are authorized to be able to be used with federal government information. So here's a great example. For those of us that are targeting CMMC level 3, it means we process CUI. The only tier of Microsoft 365 that we can use, store, process, transmit CUI, is their GCC high tier, their government compute cloud high level tier. We can't just use the regular old commercial Office 365. And that means a literal physical migration of your data to separate data centers that are staffed by verified and cleared U.S. personnel. And it means you operate a separate domain, an entirely different domain in this GCC high tier. So there are some ramifications for federal government work in the cloud. And there's only two aspects of the Amazon Web Services that are authorized to process federal government information, and it's a whole can of worms with how you use those as well. So you got to do some research. We're here to help if you don't feel equipped, or if your listeners don't feel equipped to research themselves.
Well, I think I'm going to keep this question for last and the best for last. What do you think, how do you think the cybersecurity threat landscape is going to evolve in the next coming year in 2021, now that the COVID is going to start, it's predicted to get worse and it's getting worse. What do you think is going to happen next year? Do you think ransomware is going to be the big thing, or phishing, malware? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so the single biggest threat facing all organizations of in all industries of all size is social engineering, specifically through phishing emails. That's the biggest threat we all face. And the spread of crimeware like ransomware is probably the biggest result of succumbing to that social engineering threat. I don't see that changing. Email is a ubiquitous business facilitator. Like we're not, in other words, we're not getting rid of email, and we're not. We all can fall prey to social engineering, so our adversaries know this. That'll stick around as the single biggest vector of infection. Ransomware has stayed steady for the last couple years as one of the biggest threats out there. I don't see that changing. I do see the adversary pivoting and taking advantage of, or finding ways to take advantage of us working from home more. So we as corporations need to do things like make sure our VPN, virtual private network connections, are robust, employ in the sense that they require a multi-factor authentication. So not just a username and password, but some second factor of authentication like a text message or a push notification or a one-time PIN. So multi-factor authentication and strong encryption on those VPN links is going to be really key to helping secure remote connections. And then what we advocate the most is training your users to understand what the phishing threat looks like, to understand why they have to use things like VPN to connect to the corporate network and not just try to do things like use Google Hangouts and connect back to their desktop through their personal laptop. Understand the corporate policies and best practices and why it's important to abide by them. And you can train your users for real cheap. You just have to know what the threats are that they need to be trained on and how they can help mitigate the risks represented by those threats. So bottom line, I don't see the general threats changing that much. I see the adversaries trying to pivot to take advantage of your users using BYOD stuff, so non-corporate controlled machines more. How about you?
I think it's just going to be it's just going to get worse. I think we're going to see more domain name heisting, more fictitious spoofed websites. Ransomware is going to be a big thing now, especially with healthcare industries. I've been noticing the headline that ransomware is really starting to uptick now. I think some of the older threat variants are going to be coming out in more flavors, like, again, phishing. I think Trojan horses, social engineering is a big one. And there's another one. It's on the tip of my tongue. I can't remember what I was going to say. I think a lot of the old ones coming in different forms and new flavors. And I think really what's going to be now is that the cyber attacker is taking their own sweet time to build up their profile about their targets, not just smash and grab campaigns. They're purposely studying their targets. They're taking their own sweet time. And be careful on social media. I mean, you just don't know. Even if you have just a general profile on Facebook, you just don't know who can build a profile on you with that. It's scary. That's why I don't really use Facebook. All I use is just really LinkedIn for that matter. So, but those are some of my thoughts. So, hey, Adam, I really want to tell you thank you for, I think we're getting close to the mark here. I just want to tell you thank you for your time this morning. Let's have a couple more podcasts. I think we can really talk more about this in a lot more detail. Sound good to you?
It does. Thanks for the opportunity, Robbie, and stay healthy.
Yes, you too. Be safe, and we'll be in touch. Take care.
Thanks. Take care. Bye.
Bye.